We're now switching to economic policy, and we have three exciting speakers. I will not introduce them because you have the introductions in the booklet and we're already running 10 minutes late. Each one will have 15 minutes, and then we'll have time for discussion. And to paraphrase our Prime Minister, 15 minutes means 15 minutes. And we start with George Pakoulatos of the University of Economics of Athens.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Kevin and Spiros, for the kind invitation and hospitality. I, too, am a literalist like Dimitris Sotiropoulos, so I have taken the description at heart, and I will speak about the period between 1996 and 2016, trying to summarize what has happened, taken stock, and drawing some overall conclusions. I think 20 years in 15 minutes is ambitious, but nothing compared to the flagrant immodesty of my friend Takis Papas, who summarized 150 years in 15 minutes. Now, the first, I call this Project Modernization because modernization was more than just the sum of government interventions and political strategies. It was a broader ambition of establishing a kind of hegemonic ideology within the Greek center-left and within Greek society, from which a number of initiatives emanated. I would say that the broader narrative of Europeanization and democratization, and I find the discussion that was made by Calliope before quite topical. I'll be happy to return to that in the discussion, was the kind of the flag that led this process. And I would say that what differentiated it from other efforts was that there was a clear ideological attempt to establish this broader narrative as hegemonic in Greek society, and there was a clear case of strong political ownership backing it. I would also say that this was a kind of a coming of age of a government or a country that was realizing that growth could not be produced from the mechanisms upon which the Greek economy was able to rely in the past. Namely, could not result from deficit financing because there was no way for the government to control the mechanism that financed these government deficits, as it was able to do so in the 80s, and could not emanate from some sort of protectionism or import substitution because of the single market in the European Union. So Greece had to become part of a broader European reality and not just better integrate in the single market, but I would say part of the broader reality of the economic and monetary union that was the kind of the shining house in the hill that would also ensure stability for a country with a long tradition of monetary instability and weak currency, that would inspire confidence to investors who would be able to borrow at much lower borrowing costs because of the credibility that a strong common European currency would entail. So there was a lot of kind of economic understanding behind the strategic decision to bind the country behind the European project. It was not only politically savvy, but it was also economically rational. And I say that because there is a certain degree of revisionism following the experience of the crisis. Having said that, I would also say that though, despite the strong political ownership, the forces that led this process of convergence or catch-up with euro or broader modernization, Europeanization, were largely exogenous. They had to do with the realities and the vagaries of the single market. They had to do with capital mobility, and they had to do with the whole project of Maastricht. So the external constraint was a very significant driving force, and it represented the sort of hard conditionality in the sense by which if Greece was not part of the emerging new reality of the EMU, exclusion would come at a very heavy political and national price. And that was, in a way, a sort of the substitute for a hard conditionality. That said, I would also say that this government, the 1996 to 2000 government, was to my understanding, probably Greece's best government since 1974, 1977, and I understand saying this in this room, I do not exactly swim against the tide. But it was also a kind of a record that prioritized fiscal convergence and macroeconomic stabilization. It is quite notable that electoral cycles that had been so salient in post-authoritarian Greek politics were not witnessed in 1996 and were not witnessed in 2000. And it was also limited in terms of its ambition to encompass microeconomic and structural reforms. So there was a certain shortcoming in terms of tackling the broader structural roots of underdevelopment or low competitiveness of the Greek economy. I will not go into great detail. Much of this is already known. I wanted to emphasize the reality that emerged after Greece's accession to the EMU. The first element was that the hard conditionality that I described was succeeded by a soft conditionality, which was the Stability and Growth Pact inside the euro. The sanctions were weak and they were not credible enough. And the growth impetus for the economy resulted largely from the condition of a peripheral economy that was converging with the core of the eurozone inside a single currency, which meant that cheap capital inflows were financing the growth rates. It was a case of a debt-driven growth. I emphasize here that the important thing is not only the public debt, the public borrowing in the economy, the accumulation of public debt, but it was the accumulation of net foreign indebtedness. That is what led Greece to the crisis, the degree of its net foreign indebtedness to the rest of the world. And you see here, the line that you see is the net foreign borrowing every year. This is translated into current account deficits and led to a net foreign debt of around 90% when the crisis broke. So the economy is growing through that, and by growing through that mechanism, this means that it is also achieving a level of prosperity that is funded through borrowing at the expense of future generations of taxpayers, and is translated mostly into consumption, and also to a sort of investment that is not sufficient to expand productive capacity. If this borrowing was directed to overwhelmingly productive investment, that could do the job. But much of it went to consumption. If we look at consumption spending during that period, one sees the picture, to the growth of imports and to a kind of investment that did not emphasize R&D, that did not emphasize development of skills, but was mainly centered around the non-traded sector of the economy, and a great bubble in the housing construction sector. And this, understandably, was also led by the ambition to meet the objectives of the 2004 Olympics, but it also translated into a constant real appreciation that led to an erosion of competitiveness. Greece was inflating every year at a higher rate than its partners in the eurozone, and we ended up with a huge shortfall of competitiveness. And then we come to the peak of the crisis, where it is not only reform complacency, but it is complete inertia and complete macroeconomic derailment. You see there Greece is a laggard in terms of the twin deficit. This is the average of the twin deficit, and you can see the degree of divergence of Greece from the other countries. And the important thing is also that it is not only the capital inflows that are coming inside, which created the conditions of the sudden stop that triggered the crisis in 2010. It is also the structure of the capital inflows. It is the content. The capital inflows are about debt rather than equity, the very low FDI inflows, which amplified the vulnerability post-crisis. and led to the very acute deleveraging process that we saw and kind of underwrote the steep recession, painful recession after 2010 as a mechanism of adjustment. And then in 2010, bailouts and forced adjustment. This is the hardest constraint ever, and it comes under the explicit terms of program conditionality, especially as the economy is drip-fed, kind of spoon by spoon, desperately needing funding in order to meet its official funding obligations, and this funding always comes on the back of very painful conditionality. So this is the hardest constraint. It is a policy of heavily front-loaded fiscal consolidation. I would say inevitably front-loaded fiscal consolidation, given the fact that we entered the crisis with close to 11% primary budget deficit. And internal devaluation is the only option to adjust in a single currency, trying to mimic the effects of a currency, of an external devaluation. And an external imposition of long-deferred structural reforms that had been postponed under the previous governments and were now being imposed as part of the strict conditionality of the first, mostly the second, and also the third.
Could you just tell us where the graph comes
from? The graph is the OECD Going for Growth report that shows the overall reform response for the period 2007-2014. Now, taking into account that nothing happened between 7 and 2009, you can understand that there was huge progress in terms of reform responsiveness during the period up to 2014. And these were reforms that were part of the conditionality that the Greek government after 2010 was forced to follow. Okay, Greece is number one. Greece was the red line, shows the highest record of reform. Now, let me summarize some of the MOU adjustment failures, and I'll try to be quick here. First of all, our policies were pro-cyclical, they were heavily recessionary, there were no offsetting policies, there was no counter-cyclical stimulus provided by the Eurozone, it could only be provided by the Eurozone, and much heavier fiscal consolidation measures were needed for a much poorer result. So about 30% of GDP was needed, of fiscal measures, to produce about 11% of GDP adjustment. Vicious cycles, self-feeding recession, crisis spreading across sectors, from the banking sector to the sovereign, from the sovereign to the banking, from the financial sector to the real economy, to socio-economic and political crisis and so forth, extreme socio-political conflict, maximalistic opposition, raising the political risk, which was translated as a risk of policy and political discontinuity, which was translated as a currency redenomination risk, what we have known as a Grexit risk, which led to high risk premium, which meant that even the most competitive Greek firms, even the ones that were left that were able to sustain their clientele base, sustain their and to direct their products abroad, were not able to borrow at competitive rates because they had Greece written on their forehead. And in this way, all the sacrifices that were made in terms of trying to improve labor cost competitiveness were swallowed by the higher capital costs that were not only incurred for the government sector, but also incurred for the private sector and even its most competitive parts. Failure to target reforms to improving export performance support shift to the tradable sectors. Failure to target protection to the weakest groups. About 4/5 of the long-term unemployed received no income support. A lack of ownership of reforms, insufficient reform of state judiciary, public administration. There was a serious neglect in terms of tackling serious deficiencies in Greek state institutions, and a relapse, of course, in the spring-summer 2015 when a farcical negotiation was followed by a tragic referendum leading to the disastrous capital controls that undercut any sort of anything that remained from the effort of private sector to survive. Now, taking stock of the shortcomings and failures, first of all, I'd like to point out, because Calliope and I very much agree with much of what she said, but the problem in Greece was the reforms were led by external constraint because there is not sufficient demand for reforms, and there's not sufficient supply reform. Now, supply has to do with the political system and the political and ideological constellation. Maybe part of it has to do with the fact that PASOK was not part, by its inception, part of the broader European social democratic mainstream family, but it also largely has to do with the demand side. The reforms are not demanded by Greek society, and this is associated with the powerful status quo coalitions. It is associated with the fact that the export or tradable sector in the economy, or the large competitive enterprises that advanced Western economies have, are not there in the Greek case, and there is a prevalence of status quo coalitions that include wider public sector, pensioners, small and micro enterprises that operate through tax evasion and social insurance contribution evasion, unproductively professions, etc. So the pro-reform coalition is very weak. The greatest failure, I would say, was the inability, the failure of Greece to reform when its economy was growing with over 3.5%, which is throughout the period up to 2007. And the second greatest failure was that it had, as a result of its first greatest failure, it had to reform at the time when it was on the down, on deep recession, and at the time when it also, alongside the reforms, had to implement very serious fiscal consolidation that was inevitably amplifying the recession. Now, this procyclicality, manic on the upswing, depressive on the downswing, was very much a result of weak institutions. Weak institutions at the national level, but also weak institutions at the Eurozone level. Victims have been left behind. Disinvestment and low employment rate are the legacies, unfortunately, of the crisis, undercutting the country's productive capacity and growth capacity in the future, dragging down potential output. And, of course, persisting structural weaknesses, which have not been sufficiently dealt with, also because of the self-feeding negative sort of negativity and toxicity of the crisis, low savings, high consumption, small size of firms, small export sector remains small despite the slight improvement in exports, inefficient state institutions. Now, there have been some positive elements. The deficits have been eradicated. An array of implemented reforms are with us, and I do not share at all the kind of reform nihilism that is sometimes proposed by pro-reformers who tend to say nothing happened in the last 6 years, nothing happened. A huge array of things happened. In reforms that will be with us, that will be able to exhibit the results when the economy goes back to cyclical recovery. For example, the opening up of certain professions will be able to show, to have a growth effect when the economy goes back to recovery. But you know, even if you look at tax administration, the fact that we have an independent authority for tax collection, government statistics, the overhaul of the pension system, there's a whole range of things that are real, despite the implementation deficit that obviously is a part of the problem as well. Improved government capacity, our governments are finally operating along measurable, concrete targets. They are judged upon them and milestones. Long gone, or not much long gone, but not with us, is the period when everything was sort of fuzzy and a part of the political will, as we always used to say. There is, I believe, a folk memory against over-indebtedness. It has been inscribed now in collective consciousness that you should not over-borrow. This was not an issue before. There's a sort of a learning by suffering. And also a new consensus for fiscal discipline that goes across the party political system. I would say that the radical left in the form of Syriza has also graduated from the extreme populism to the discourse of necessity. So from the shenanigans of Zoe to the reality of Tina, Tina being that there is no alternative. This is not a happy graduation, and this is not a graduation by choice, but it is one by necessity, and it does the job very well. Growing pragmatism, if anyone looked from outside and saw a country that has suffered, lost 25% of GDP, and the poverty levels over 30%, and unemployment, and sees the first MOU voted by one party, the second by three, and the third by five. Now, this is something that one cannot understand. But there is a growing understanding and appreciation of the lack of an alternative, which I think is the driving force behind that. Finally, opportunities low gross financing needs, shielded from markets, positive interdependency with Eurozone partners, possibility to import technical assistance and know-how, possibility to relaunch the economy on a sustainable footing, which, however, we have not seen yet. And this is my final slide. Risks and challenges. Short-term targets might be too ambitious. Policy discontinuity, socio-political rupture are a huge looming threat. On the longer term, the ability to sustain the reforms that will allow the Greek economy to grow, this has been underlined very frequently by the IMF, given the demographics, given the cost of the pension system and the weak support for productivity-enhancing reforms, the risk of debt overhang, the erosion of a pro-euro majority. Greece has an internal antinomy in its public opinion. There's a majority against the reforms and the austerity programs, and there's a majority in support of the euro. Now, at some point, this might be resolved in a way that could begin to seriously destabilize the anchoring of the country behind the euro project. And finally, a volatile EU and international environment, which is undercutting the ability of Europe to operate as the precious external anchor that it has always been. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Next speaker is Miranda Xafa.
Hello, everybody, and congratulations on the 20th anniversary of the Hellenic Observatory. So my presentation is divided in three parts. The first focuses on macro developments in the run-up to the crisis. The second is an argument that austerity is not Greece's problem. And the third part is on ending the crisis. What do we need to do to end the crisis? George covered pretty much the first part, so I'll just skim over it and focus only on a couple of slides by way of introduction to the second and third parts. So most people look at, from the peak to now, and they say, well, what a disaster, Greek GDP has declined by 25% in real terms. But they forget to look at the preceding period, which shows that the whole thing was a bubble, that now we're back to where we were just before Greece joined EMU. So when people compare Greece to the United States, the United States in the Great Depression of the 30s, and they say, well, the decline now is of the similar magnitude to what the U.S. went through, they usually overlook the fact that this is a boom and bust, that Greece's impressive pre-crisis growth was unsustainable because it was based on a debt-financed consumer boom. This chart shows that Greece's unit labor costs rose far above not just the German unit labor costs, but also the euro area average. Because once Greece joined the euro area, there was an expectation that per capita incomes should converge to the euro area average in one giant leap. And so wage increases far outpaced productivity growth, and the result was that resources moved from the tradable sector, where prices are set by global competition, to the sheltered sectors, mainly retail trade and construction. And the export base was eroded. The current account deficit grew to 15% of GDP at the peak of the crisis, 2007-2008. So just as the global crisis hit, Greece was one of the most vulnerable countries, relying excessively on external borrowing at a time when there was a risk-off, huge risk-off episode in global capital markets. Greece's per capita income growth exceeded most of the other PIGs, the PIGs being the periphery of the euro area. So you can see that Greece's per capita income grew by nearly as much as Ireland's without having nearly the same productive capacity or the same possibility to attract investment, and far faster than the other PIGs. And so it was all, as George said, it was all debt-financed consumer boom. During this period, from 1999 to 2007, growth averaged almost 4% per year, and yet debt rose steadily. Here you can see the exact numbers. Per capita income growth in Greece nearly equal to that of Ireland, three times as fast as Italy and Portugal. And at the same time, Greece is the only country besides Portugal where debt is piling up and where the current account deficit has reached a huge deficit, far greater than in any of the other countries. So now, I will argue that austerity is not Greece's problem right now. There is a critique of Greece's EU-IMF-financed adjustment programs. The argument is that they imposed too much austerity and they delayed the necessary debt restructuring. Joe Stiglitz and other sort of left-of-center economists argue that austerity should be relaxed and that debt should be forgiven to make room for more spending. It's true that external borrowing, of course, was gradually reduced under the three bailouts, as official creditors were obviously not willing to fund spending at the level that triggered the crisis. But austerity is not Greece's problem, because thanks to unprecedented official largesse, the country has made near zero debt service payments out of its own resources since 2010, or even before 2010. And here you can see the overall deficit, fiscal deficit of Greece is the blue line, and the red line is the primary balance. The difference between the two is interest payments. So you can see that the red line, the primary balance, was above zero, meaning a primary surplus, only until 2003. So only in the Simitis years was there a primary surplus, and then the primary surplus disappeared, and even during the period of the memoranda from 2010 onwards, Greece has not really managed to produce a primary surplus, meaning that interest payments, and of course amortization payments, are paid out entirely from borrowed money. Until 2008, borrowed from international capital markets, and since then, borrowed from official creditors. It's hard to see any austerity taking place in the Greek public sector. The general government compensation of employees, the left panel, shows that, of course, GDP has declined, but compensation of employees, the wage bill of the government, has not declined nearly at the same pace as GDP, so it has increased considerably as a percent of GDP. And on the right panel, we can see the social benefits, which includes pensions. We can see pension spending is out of control, even under the three bailout packages. So I conclude from all that that competitiveness, not austerity, is Greece's problem. So Greece never had the productive structure to have as high per capita income as it did. Its income was just inflated by massive borrowing, which was not really used to upgrade its productive capacity. Investment has declined since 2010. It used to be around 20% of GDP. It's now below 10%. There is a very interesting study, the Atlas of Economic Complexity by Ricardo Hausmann, a professor at Harvard, which shows that in 2008, when the global crisis hit, the gap between Greece's income and the knowledge content of its exports was the largest among a sample of 128 countries. That is a very, very striking observation. Greece's exports of goods consist mainly of fruits, olive oil, raw cotton, tobacco, and refined petroleum. Greece does not produce machines, electronics, or chemicals, and its share of world trade in IT is near zero. tourism alone, which is Greece's strength, is not enough to offset this dismal performance. In addition to this problem, there is this self-inflicted wound. The protracted negotiation with creditors in 2015 was a huge setback to the adjustment effort. The uncertainty slowed the economy to far below stall speed. So whereas the economy was recovering in 2014, it fell back into recession in 2015 and 2016 and is trying to recover 3 years later to the 2014 level. The primary surpluses, of course, shrunk, and the borrowing requirements increased considerably, adding to the debt. Banks had to be recapitalized with $5.5 billion of taxpayers' money. The equity stake of $25.5 billion in banks that had been acquired by the state in the aftermath of the debt restructuring of 2012 is worth zero today. Remember that these shares were supposed to be sold in the market after a number of years and used to reduce the debt. So that money is now gone. Bank deposits fell by more than $40 billion, so that's one-third of the cumulative decline since the crisis hit. And capital controls that were imposed in June of 2015 are still in place. The Greek economy, as I said, returned to recession and has decoupled from the rest of the euro area. You can see how the euro area is slowly recovering, but Greece really plummeted. Expectations of consumers and investors really plummeted in 2015 in the aftermath of the challenge that the Greek government had with the confrontation with creditors, and is only recovering very slowly, remaining way below the long-term average. Credit spreads are above where they were in 2014, so the government is hoping that Greece will return to the market in next year, but it's hard to see how this will happen with credit spreads as high as they are. Remember that in 2014, Greece managed to do two issues of GGBs, Greek government bonds, and now it's hard to see how it can return to the market with credit spreads where they are today. This just shows how the equity stake in the four systemic banks was fully diluted and how deposits fell by $41 billion. That's one-third of the cumulative decline since the peak. Bank lending is unlikely to recover soon. Deposits are flat since controls were imposed, and credit is still contracting. As a result, the euro system still funds about a third of the bank balance sheets, mostly through ELA, the Exceptional Liquidity Assistance. Non-performing loans amount to 52% of total loans outstanding. And Deputy Finance Minister Houliarakis said last year that capital controls will remain in place at least until mid-2016, but there has been radio silence since then. Austerity is not a choice. So countries that have lost market access like Greece or face very high risk premium like Spain and Italy did, have no choice. You know, they have to bring their budget deficit to a sustainable fiscal path in order to receive official funding. Lenders will not fund spending at the level that got the country into trouble in the first place. So in the euro area periphery, austerity is not a matter of fine-tuning demand. It's not a Keynesian approach. It's a matter of ensuring the government's solvency. And solvency, of course, depends on growth prospects and debt service obligations. Now, how can we end this crisis, and how can we restore competitiveness? Structural impediments to growth, what are they? They prevent capital and labor from being allocated to more productive uses. Rigid labor and product markets impede the rebalancing of economies in Greece and in most of southern Europe. Weak insolvency regimes and inefficient judicial systems have prevented the restructuring of private sector debts, which are essential for banks to deal with their vast portfolio of non-performing loans, and also for corporates to return to profitability. They need to get rid of debt. High tax rates, red tape, political opposition to privatization discourage the supply of new equity that Greece needs so much. Greece does not need more debt, it needs more equity. So removing structural impediments is essential to growth. Removing these impediments is necessary for growth to restart and for the debt to become viable in the longer term. ECB President Draghi often reminds us of that when discussing the limits of monetary policy. The euro area is a currency union that lacks automatic stabilizers because the EU budget is so tiny. Member states that cannot rebalance their economies will be unable to absorb shocks. Non-performing loans tie up valuable capital and loanable funds, and banks should really be turning their attention to identifying investment opportunities, not dealing with NPLs. The World Bank's Doing Business report was for 2017 was published last month. It shows that Greece is ranked 61st among 190 countries, down from 60th place the year before, and 18th out of 19 euro area countries. And within this overall ranking, Greece still ranks very low in the areas of registering property. It's 141st, enforcing contracts, etc. So investment ratios, as I said, have dropped sharply. Exports are picking up part of the slack in the rest of the euro area, but not in Greece. So the key problem is that Greece needs supply-side reforms. Syriza-led government has done very little to promote these reforms. It believes austerity is the problem and advocates raising wages and pensions. In other words, returning to the policies that led to the crisis. So that will not do the trick. Also, adjustment has relied very heavily on taxes. You can see the blue line is the taxes, the red line the expenditure. The expenditure is still not back to pre-crisis levels, but tax revenue is way above the pre-crisis level. I mean, you know the key features of the ESM program. There is trouble brewing because official creditors disagree on the way forward. The IMF believes that 3.5% primary surplus is too ambitious for Greece and wants the Europeans to reduce that target. It says that the current program is not going to achieve 3.5% primary target. So either the target needs to be reduced or Greece needs to take more measures. And that's where we are. Hopefully by the December 5th Eurogroup, this issue will be resolved. So there are a number of reforms that the IMF is proposing. I won't go through them now, but perhaps in the Q&A we can discuss them further. And also there are a number of structural reforms the IMF is proposing, not just on NPLs, but on labor market reform, product market liberalization, ways to attract investment, opening the closed professions, and privatizing the economy. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Miranda. The final speaker is Professor Christos Doulakis.
First of all, I would like to thank the Hellenic Observatory for giving me the opportunity to be here in the 20th anniversary. And in my speech, I will try to describe some of the characteristics of the Greek crisis and the reasons behind some failures that have been observed over the last years. I start with a slide which has been shown before by George and shows the reform intensity that characterized Greece over the last 7 years. And you see that Greece now has become a champion in reforms, by far surpassing the European Union average. And I think that now the question arises, if we actually do all these reforms, why these do not work? And Greece continues to suffer a huge recession, which is unparalleled in peacetime. And I think that apart from the explanations that have been given before, it's worth trying to link the failure of reforms to produce growth to the recession itself. And I think that one of the reasons why market reforms have not been effective in speeding up growth in Greece has been that recession has made several of them not to be in a position to operate efficiently. And responsible for that has been the front-loaded fiscal consolidation, but also the asphyxiation of the banking system, which actually hinders many growth initiatives to take place. And this has led to a very severe deterioration of market functioning that made several of these reforms to be practically non-operative. But I think that another reason why these reforms failed to produce growth has been that Greece is lacking institutional credibility and that the low quality of credibility has deteriorated over the last few years. And it is shown in the reversibility of lawmaking and also in several occasions of discretionary intervention in lawmaking. And I also think that this is explained by the ever-expanding pressure groups which either block or prevent in several ways the application of reforms. I think that some reforms, although they have been very well-intentioned, failed to lead to growth opportunities because demand was very low. And I would like to bring to your attention two examples which were very characteristic of the way that some reforms actually failed to take notice of the surrounding economic environment. One famous reform has been the liberalization of the truck lorry licenses, which was implemented in 2010 after a prolonged period of conflict, the protests, and actual harm to the economy. But if you look at the results, you see that instead of actually liberating the vocation of truck lorry licenses, actually led to a further to a further recession on that. Before the reform took place, there were about 372, even more sometimes, new licenses that were given per year. And you see that after the reform took place, because there was no serious demand, actually they have fallen into very low amounts. And a similar experience has been observed when another reform, which has been debated for a long time in Parliament, regarding the milk market, took place. Now, the argument at that time was that the milk market in Greece was uncompetitive in relation to the European one. And one indicator for that was that the milk price in Greece was something like about 20% higher than the European average. And if the market was liberated, then this would increase competitiveness and a lower price. But in fact, after the reform took place, we saw that first that production domestic production fell, and the competitive disadvantage actually got worse. And now the disadvantage is about 40% over the European price. So I think that there must be a relationship between recession and failure of reforms to show up in growth terms. At the same time, there has been a continuous deterioration of any competitiveness indicators regarding Greece. So that according to the International Management Directorate, the relative competitive index for Greece has reached depths of deterioration after 2009, and more particularly after 2012. If you use the World Bank indicator regarding the quality of the market environment, you may get an idea of a closer relationship between the quality of market functioning and economic activity. And you saw that market quality in Greece seemed to have increased over the between 1995 until 2005, but then gradually deteriorated, more or less in line with the recession that hit Greece over the same period. And the reason perhaps is that recession makes opportunities to diminish and therefore makes the whole function of the economy to get worse. Don't think that this is just a Greek phenomenon, because the same picture of market functioning deterioration is observed also in Italy. You see systematic deterioration after the global crisis, in Spain, using the same World Bank indicator, and also in Portugal. And in fact, this deterioration in Greece does not concern only the market functioning, but also characterizes other parameters of public life in general and economic activity in particular. So you see that over the same time, not only the regulatory quality, but also the governance, the law enforcement, and accountability deteriorate. And, of course, this creates a very adverse environment in which a lot of reforms are bound to fail. But also promoting reforms in a recessionary environment creates a lot of resistance, and of course the most powerful groups in society resist more successfully than the others. So what we see in Greece is that the weakest part of the population, especially the employees in the private sector, has suffered the worst consequences of the adjustments that have taken place through the memorandums over the last 5 years. Just during the last 3 years, you see that the total economy average wage has fallen by 4.5%, although the wages in the loss-making public companies remained more or less stagnant. In some other public companies, actually, wages went even higher. And at the same time, the minimum to average salary ratio in Greece has fallen after 2011, and from about 36% that was 5 years ago, now it has gone below 32%, which means that the weaker parts of the population are hit most, and this creates a very negative atmosphere in endorsing reforms and in providing political support for their implementation. But at the same time, we have seen that the institutions became more dysfunctional because of the reversibility of laws and an intense activity in discretions and interventions which characterized quite a lot of reforms and arrangements that have taken place. I use here some results which have been produced by Professor Sotiropoulos in his book, and shows the transitional arrangements which take place in lawmaking in Greece. You see that in average over the last years, there has been something like between 100 or 200 amendments every year, But this record has surged after 2010, precisely because pressure groups got mobilized even stronger and trying to secure their own position against the others. Even if you measure these amendments as percent of the main articles which are approved by Parliament, you see that although amendments were kept between 10 and 20%, now again they surge of up to 30%, precisely because the clientelistic pressures increased too much ever since. In fact, the increase in pressure groups which try to defend themselves becomes evident if you look at the public entities that exist in Greece. Everybody would expect that the size of the public sector would lower as a result of the implementation of the austerity program. But in fact, by using some provision of data by the Greek Statistical Service, it shows that the number of public entities increases. And even when some reforms target to the reduction of political personnel or institutions, sometimes the opposite happens. A famous reform has been the contraction of municipalities into bigger entities, the so-called this program. And the paradoxical result has been that the number of political personnel involved in the elections, in the local elections, has increased, despite the fact that the number of municipalities were reduced from about 1,025 to 325, which is a huge reduction. Then the involvement in all this political machinery at local level has increased, and the number of people who got elected. And of course, all these people are candidates for forming various pressure groups in order to defend, to claim, to exercise pressure and all these type of things. I think that perhaps the starkest manifestation of the reform failures, despite the huge political cost which has paid for them to be implemented, can be seen in the huge disinvestment that characterizes the Greek economy after the crisis. The blue line shows net fixed investment as a ratio to GDP, and the other two lines show how this variable behaved in the northern European countries and in the southern European countries, except Greece. And you see that Greece, although both groups in the north and the south of the Eurozone suffered some decline in investment activity, the effect for Greece has been catastrophic. And this is not due just to the recession and the fall, to the fall of GDP, because this is taken into account since this is net fixed investment as percent of GDP. But somehow, large parts... Yeah, net fixed investment.
It's private fixed investment.
No, no, altogether, including both.
It's 10%.
No, it's it costs 10%.
No, it's 10%. I know.
But now, actually, Greece is suffering for several years net fixed disinvestment, which practically means destruction of physical capital. And I'm afraid that what was said before by Professor Sotiropoulos, that Themelis mentioned that only the cement works are going to survive the modernization of the 90s, I'm afraid that this is not happening. Because you see that even the cement works actually now gradually are destroyed and disappear. What can be done about that? In my view, unless we restore this investment profile into a positive trajectory, nothing else can be done, because the economy is bound to remain stuck in deep recession, and however many reforms you vote for in order to create incentives or whatever else you call them, the economy is not moving. At this point, there are two schools of thought. One school says that eventually all this stock of reforms is bound to be energized and will attract the economy on a speedy growth path. How this is going to happen, nobody knows exactly, but eventually there might be some awakening of the nation which will drive all of us into better days and higher activity. The other school of thought hopes that some Deus Ex Machina will appear all of a sudden, which will somehow make a miracle in order to move the economy on a growth path. The second school of thought reflects the current government thinking, which before was believing that it's easy to tear off the memorandum and unleash the economic forces. Now they believe that they might tear away the public debt, and this will exert such a great relief on the Greek economy that will push all the creative forces onwards. But I'm afraid both these assumptions are not too realistic, and the hope that Greece can consider as given the achievements that have been realized so far regarding the public deficit and external deficit are not warranted. First of all, I believe that the external deficit has been miraculously contained, but this is not due to an increased and healthy exportability of the Greek economy, but mainly to the containment of imports because of this, of the slumping demand. Here I have a graph which shows how the competitiveness index for the Greek economy, which is measured by using unit labor cost indices, has been improved by 25% over the last 6 years. But at the same time, you can see that after 2012, when this domestic devaluation took full effect, the value of exports has remained virtually the same. So it doesn't seem to all this correction of competitiveness to convey any momentum to the exportability of Greek production. And this, to me, implies that problems in the external account are bound to resurface as soon as demand starts to go up. I'm afraid that similar doubt is justified also for the fiscal achievement of reducing public deficits from the horrendous minus 14% or 15% of GDP, whatever it was, now to a primary surplus of 2%. I think that this has been achieved overwhelmingly by raising taxes. And everybody knows, even the present government understands fully well that you cannot achieve growth by keeping taxation at such a high and complicated level. So taxation is bound. Okay, one minute. So taxation, I think, is bound to relax. But if taxation is relaxed, and at the same time, all these pressure groups I described before start to become more active, I think that public deficit is going to come under pressure as well for further expansion. And I think that at this point of time, we have to bring some lessons which were taught by Ulysses. Lesson one is that if you don't, I'm sorry, if the first lesson is that you should not get stuck in a problem, and if you cannot avoid it, then you have to face it. And I think that at the present day, it's hopeless anymore to talk about changing or whatever else, the memorandum or the directions and all these type of things. I think that the best opportunity for the country is to complete the memorandum and then try to create the conditions that a new one is not needed anymore. I think that in the same line, we should negotiate the fiscal surpluses which are required. I think that the requirement by the European institutions for a 3% public surplus is unrealistic, and perhaps I think a more realistic one should be below 2%. But if they insist so much in keeping pressure on revenue collection, I think a good compromise would be to agree on a 2% primary surplus target and use the rest, which is between 1% or 2%, in order to finance public investment that will help the rest of investment activity to go up as well. The second lesson is that if we're going to avoid the Syrians, we must tie the decision maker on the mast. And I think that in order to avoid the deterioration of public debt and deficit in the future, we cannot rely anymore on the continuation of moratoriums, because these are associated with a lot of malfunctioning and other problems in Greek society. I think that the best way is to try to imitate Spain, that has included rules in its constitution on how to use and employ fiscal rules regarding debt and deficit. Second is that we need to minimize exceptions and special rulings in lawmaking, so that we make the Greek population to feel that everybody pays a right portion of the sacrifice which is needed in order to bring the Greek economy back on growth. And of course, I think that we need to pay more attention to the containment of public sector in order to give incentives to the private sector, which has been hugely neglected over the last few years. Finally, what is missing, and this is very surprising, is that although we had too many reforms over the last few years, we never saw a proper assessment of the impact of reforms. So we don't exactly know, I mean, what has been gained by applying this or the other form. And I think that this is, in my view, a vital element if we're going to make our understanding better on which reforms have been successful, so we have to continue them, and which of them have failed miserably, and we have to neutralize them. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you very much to Nikos and the all three. We do have some time for questions because we started 10 minutes late, so I'm going to extend this by 10 minutes, if not more. Yeah, there's again, I'll take two questions. So there's one here, one there, and who's number three? All right, I'll give you number three. Just. Try telling us who you are.
Professor of Economics at Pantheon. I have a question for Nikos Christodoulakis, actually, because although I sympathize with lots of what he said, I have the feeling that his presentation of the two reforms, the fresh milk and the lorry drivers thing, were both misleading. Because the issue is not how to extend the length of the fresh milk from 3 to 5 days, but how to extend it in line with European standards so as to allow entrance in the Greek market. So if you extend it from 3 days that it was to five, it's still impossible for any competitor to enter the market due to geographical and distance reasons. So you should not count it as a reform. Actually, it's a very good example of a half reform, which in reality makes even more solid the earlier privileges of the protected sector. And for the lorry drivers, it's again the same. We have over a million of private one-person licenses. I would not expect them to be expanded during the recession.
By the way, in case you didn't know, milk reform was made is what made Margaret Thatcher famous in the 1970s and became prime minister after that. So it's a good place to start. I think I already promised to, down there in here. She was known as the snatcher, yeah, Thatcher the snatcher.
Thank you. Anna Tsivtsoglu, postdoctoral fellow at the LSE. Question to Professor Christodoulakis first, and then a second one to Dr. Xafa. Professor Christodoulakis, in your view and from your political experience as a minister, do you think that the Greek society, and I'm talking about the average Greek citizen, really wants modernization? Because from what I view from your talk and from Professor Papas previously talked about the social legitimation, I don't think and I don't see social legitimation because of all that lobbying that you see in the legislative procedure against reforms. That's my first question. And the second question to Dr. Xafa. Even if all those reforms that you mentioned and you analyzed were to take place, if they were to take place, do you think that without significant debt relief, Greece will ever get out of this crisis? And in your view and from your experience, do you think that there will be sometime debt relief? And how the political play now, in what's the state of the political play now for this?
Okay, thank you. And then George.
Okay, a brief question. I found myself in agreement with all three of the presentations, and also they were in agreement among themselves too. But the question is, how do we engineer a recovery? Because I agree that we need a recovery in order for the reforms to show through, without reawakening the problem of external imbalances. I mean, this is the big, big question for Greece now. I mean, the crisis was a crisis, an external debt crisis, really, as George Pavlatos said. It was not only a fiscal crisis, external debt crisis, the refinancing of the debt. But how do we engineer a recovery now, and can Greece engineer a recovery by itself without reawakening the external imbalances problem?
Okay, well, should we do it in reverse order because you have more questions asked? So,
first of all, regarding the two examples of failed reforms that I gave, basically I agree with you. I didn't make the reforms, the government made the reforms. And the government actually made them to sound so dramatic. You may remember that when the milk reform was discussed in Parliament, the ministers were saying that if we don't vote for this, Greece is going to suffer a million things, among them exiting from the euro. It was a big thing to vote for the milk reform that was simply extending the duration of freshness. That was all. And what happened then? Because of the Russian embargo, the European Union actually was flooded with milk reserves, which were very cheap and were massively exported to Greece. As a result, several milk producing units in Greece were shut down. Agno shut down, was shut down, Nestlé, Delta, and Fage. So four major milk industries were shut down in Greece. And the majority of commerce now is taking place through some speculating importers. And as a result, the price went up. So instead of having 20% disadvantage vis-à-vis the European Union, now we have 45% disadvantage. What went wrong?
We understand, Amit. Next question.
The next question is the lorry drivers. No. I agree with you. There is no point to put so much political emphasis and political cost, by the way, on reforming the driving license for the public lorries, because there were so many thousands of private lorries. But nevertheless, the government
wasted a huge political capital on insisting on this without any practical benefits. Regarding the ownership of the funds, which was the question by the lady in the back, I say that it depends which citizens you ask. If you ask an employee in the private sector, if you want to own the reforms, say no, thank you very much. Because all the reforms I have seen so far regard wage cuts. And then the next reform is, again, a further wage cut, because we need to reinvigorate competitiveness. And then the next reform is a further cut on the pension, which I'm expected to get. And then the next reform is a rise on the national insurance contributions that I have to pay, and all these type of things. So I think that regarding this vast categories of population, to which nobody pays any sort of political attention, because all the public debate is dominated by public employees, the public, the government, the state, apart from all these type of things. Nobody talks about private sector employees. They do not exist. They only pay taxes and get their wages cut. That was all. So if you ask them, no, they don't put ownership. So I think that it's absolutely critical that we close the holes that allows the consequences of reforms not to reach everybody in Greece. I think it's vital to establish a sense of egalitarianism in implementing the sacrifices which we need and the type of reforms.
Okay, let's ask Miranda about the external balances.
Well, when President Obama was visiting Greece, Prime Minister Tsipras drew an unfortunate comparison between Greece and the United States, saying that unlike the United States, which followed expansionary monetary and fiscal policies after the global crisis hit in 2009, Greece was forced to suffer austerity. And of course, the reason it's unfortunate, this comparison, is that Greece was bankrupt. So, you know, if you lose access to capital markets, you don't have a choice. You have to reduce consumption. Now, the way to minimize the pain of adjustment is to protect incomes by selling to foreigners what Greeks can no longer afford to buy. But that requires structural reforms. You need to produce things that other countries want to buy. So if the new companies in Greece are all cafeterias, you're not going to achieve that. And this, I think, is the answer to George's question. Greece desperately needs foreign investment. As Nikos said, savings in Greece are very low. Both savings and investment are very low. So Greece does not have the savings to fund investment. Greece has a lot to learn from Ireland, but attracting foreign investment, large companies coming into Greece, requires a huge number of reforms, reducing taxation, reducing red tape, reforming the labor market, and so on. And I think that's the answer to how to restart growth without restarting the imbalances.
Thanks. I very much agree on George Zaloskoufis' question. I very much agree with Miranda on that. A demand stimulus in the Greek economy, which some have advocated from the beginning of the crisis, first of all, came across a very serious difficulty. There was no one there to fund it. But even if there were, it would only, under the certain the existing circumstances, would only exacerbate the current account imbalances. The answer to that, of course, is that you need a kind of a stimulus if it is directed to investment, because that expands productive capacity and raises the potential growth rate. But most of all, you need the kind of rebalancing that Miranda just spoke about, to direct more products and services to external demand, to market them to foreign markets. This is already happening to a certain extent. We have this substitution. For example, the housing sector now, a very significant part of real estate, is sold or rented out to foreigners. Unfortunately, much of it happens not under the formal economy, but still it is a welcome change because it brings, it raises incomes at home. In the services sector, anecdotally, I know a number of small companies that ran out of clients under the Greek recession and are now selling either their IT services or their public relations services to foreigners. So there's been this forced rebalancing which has come as a result of the lack of domestic demand. But of course, if you look at the broad picture, exports have not picked up. If you compare it with Portugal, they haven't picked up. Recently, there was a study that asked startup entrepreneurs the question, where would they have invested were they to start again their startup? Greece was the last one in a number of about, I think, 40 countries or something, because not only EU countries, there were other countries as well, the last. Portugal, which would have been expected to be among the last, a very similar country to Greece, was among the top three. Portugal had the most impressive high-tech fair, I think they called it Web Fair or something, just a few weeks ago, which was the greatest IT event that has happened in Europe for the last few years. There were tens of thousands of new companies that came in to join and find partners on the IT sector. So, you know, if you ask about why aren't exports growing and why isn't the value added of the exports growing, one should look at the lack of state initiatives, and of course one should look at the obvious features that are crippling all such efforts, the capital controls that have killed companies that have been making business abroad, at least for the first several months, the lack of import credit, which cripples companies that need imports as raw materials in order to produce exports, and of course, something that Aristos Doxiadis has studied extensively, there is a serious problem with the very small size of Greek firms, that such a small size Greek firms cannot really export. They cannot tap into new markets, and therefore we need a larger size of companies in order to be able to raise our export capacity.
Thank you very much. We're already running over, but Nikos wants to have a very quick word in response to Andrew's questions, and then we'll go for lunch.
Well, Miranda raised the issue of the very low savings rates, which makes impossible the financing of the huge investment that Greece needs now. By the way, the capital and bank deposits that have fled Greece since the crisis amounts to more than 100 billion euros, which accidentally is the gap in investment financing that Greece is suffering from. So I think that an absolute prerequisite for inducing growth to Greece is that all these people, who include many entrepreneurs, corporations in Greece and things like that, should somehow be incentivized to bring their money back to the country. Otherwise, I'm afraid that however many foreign investors appear to like Greece and their competitive advantage and all these type of things, it's very unlikely to move into the country when they see that the main players in the country move out.
But part of the money has been spent.
Yeah. Paying taxes.
Not that much. Not that one abroad.
It's been spent by buying houses abroad.
Okay, thank you very much, everyone.